of a tenth, just call Cheryl Bertile at 877-288-1077 or send her an email at volunteer@AveMariaRadio.net. Another easy way to help is to go to our homepage at AveMariaRadio.net and click the volunteer button. God bless you.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest has been on the show before. He's one of my favorite guests, Joseph Pierce, well-known writer and lecturer about things literary and theological, is the director of the Center for Faith and Culture at Aquinas College in Nashville, Tennessee. He's also the editor of the St. Austin Review, an international review of Catholic culture, and the editor of the Ignatius Critical Editions, which are published by Ignatius Press. Joseph, welcome to Church and Culture.
It's great to be back with you, Dale.
And we're going to talk about Shakespeare and Catholicism today, about which you have written three books, all published by Ignatius Press, The Quest for Shakespeare in 2008, Through Shakespeare's Eyes, 2010, and Shakespeare on Love. In 2013, I supposed you avoided Shakespeare in Love because of the film, right?
Well, that's certainly worth avoiding, but I must confess my title was meant as a bit of a riposte to that particular film, yeah.
Yeah, I had a feeling. We'll talk about that in a minute. In the meantime, you have taken on a new role at Aquinas College in Nashville as director of the Center for Faith and Culture. Tell us a little bit about the center.
Yeah, well, I'm very excited at my new role here. I took up the position last summer, so I'm in my first academic year here. What I'm hoping the Center for Faith and Culture will become is sort of like a catalyst for a new cultural revival. Obviously, I've written a lot about the Catholic cultural revival in the 20th and the 19th centuries, but obviously we're in great need of a Catholic revival in the 21st century, and I'm hoping that the work I'm doing at the Center for Faith and Culture with my colleagues will enable us to do that. And one or two things we've got, for instance, we've launched the Aquinas Award for Fiction to help encourage new Catholic fiction. We've got two essay contests for high school juniors and seniors on Shakespeare and on Tolkien and Lewis, and Shakespeare and Christianity Festival, and other things, exciting things that we're organizing here. So I'm very excited to be part of it.
Well, how can people be in touch with you and the center if, for example, they're interested in getting in on one of these essay contests?
Or anything to do with the Center for Faith and Culture at all, then contact me directly by going to Aquinas.com. That's the website, and they should then make contact to me and to the center via that website.
So, are you telling me that Aquinas College in Nashville got the URL, Aquinas.com?
Thank you for correcting me, Dale. You're on the ball. AquinasCenter.com.
Thank you.
AquinasCenter.com.
Okay. Because, I mean, I would be surprised if some Dominican hadn't snatched that up right away beginning.
Sure, it's not available. I'm actually quite surprised we got AquinasCenter.com. But
you did. There are a few others of those, not as distinguished as yours. But
exactly. Not now. We have the URL name. That's all that matters, as you know.
That makes you king of the hill. Joseph, the last time you were on, we talked about your recent memoir, and I want to just remind people of that. Not my race, but Race with the Devil, My Journey from Racial Hatred to Rational Love, which was published in 2013 by St. Benedict. Fascinating story of your life, at least how you've emerged out of some early bouts with racism and a little bit of hostility, if I might put it that way. But we're going to talk about Shakespeare today, and one reason I ask you to do this, I've been reading voraciously about the Shakespearean age and about the culture and the recusancy history, and I saw numerous references to Shakespeare, most of which were insinuating that he probably was a Catholic. And so I've started looking into it, and naturally I thought of you and your book, The Quest for Shakespeare, and then Through Shakespeare's Eyes. And I thought we could talk about it in its various contexts. I suppose the most recent bit of news was this first folio found last December, I believe, in France, on the site of a Jesuit, was it a seminary, a university, or just a residence?
It was, in Shakespeare's time, it was a seminary. Obviously, in Shakespeare's time, you couldn't have Catholic seminaries in England, so the seminaries to train English priests were on the continent.
And some of the articles suggested that finding this first folio, which of course is very rare to find them, in a what was a Jesuit seminary, suggests maybe more evidence of his Catholicity. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think it's more, should we say, buttressing evidence. There's a whole bulk of evidence out there, so it certainly doesn't depend upon this, but it's an extra contributing piece of the puzzle, if you like, which is suggestive of Shakespeare's Catholicism. At the very, very least, it shows that the Jesuits at that seminary at the time of Shakespeare's life were sufficiently positively inclined towards Shakespeare to be buying the folio, presumably performing the plays. We know that the Shakespeare's plays were performed by Catholic households during his time. At the very least that, but also Father Peter Millward, the Jesuit priest out in Japan, who's made a lifelong study of...
I've noticed his work sort of researching this for this show.
He wrote to me fairly recently giving all sorts of evidence for the actual name on the folio, the owner of the folio, and connections with that name and possible connections with that name and Shakespeare himself. So there's even, if you like, a personal connection from the name on that folio and Shakespeare himself. So it certainly is an additional piece of evidence.
At least it proves the Jesuits in exile had good taste, and
the minimalist position would be that.
And I want you to explain a little bit to our listening audience about this term recusancy. It's a tricky word. You see it a lot. A lot of people, I think, read about it and don't bother to look it up. But as I found, it really has a very dramatic meaning. Could you explain?
Yes, indeed. We have to remember that for a period of 150 years, from the 1530s, when Henry VIII instigated the break with Rome, right through to the 1680s, for a period of 150 years, Catholics were being put to death, mostly priests, but certainly not exclusively priests, were being put to death merely for endeavoring to practice their faith in England. And it was compulsory to attend the state religion, the state church.
To go to Mass each Sunday.
The Anglican Church. To go to the Anglican services, it was compulsory to attend Anglican services. So the recusants were those who refused to attend Anglican services, and in that refusal, that recusancy, they were fined. And those fines could be extremely, extremely heavy, the equivalent of tens of thousands of dollars today.
So recusancy comes from a Latin term meaning to refuse.
Exactly.
So they were the great refusers.
Yeah, they were people that basically had the courage of their convictions. And as you know, Dale, you know, there's always applicability. We're moving forward today with the ascendancy of a new secular fundamentalism, and things could get tough. And I think that one of the lessons we learn from the reticence is that, you know, ultimately Christ promises that we'll be persecuted. They'll persecute you as they persecuted me, and that the cross is unavoidable. And what they show us by example is what it takes to be a hero and a saint, and those two things are essentially synonymous, in times of trouble, in times of persecution, when things aren't going so well. So for me, the reticence, so the English reticence of that Elizabethan and Jacobean period are immensely inspirational.
Yes, especially St. Edmund Campion and many of the Jesuits who spent so much time hiding in little specially built, tiny little closets deep within these, large estates of the Catholic, the remaining Catholic families. And that actually leads to one of the arguments that's made on behalf of his Catholicity is that he spent time in the most densely populated area of England. Is it Lancashire?
Yeah, there is a body.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Lancashire.
And that the Lancashire connection would account for the so-called lost year. So tell our listeners, what are Shakespeare's lost years, and what do we mean when we say spending time in Lancashire might have been evidence for his being Catholic?
Well, yeah, the lost years is a period of time that we don't really know where Shakespeare was or what he was doing. This is the time before he's famous. It's the time before he moves to London and starts writing his plays. But it's obviously a mystery, and we want to know as much about Shakespeare as possible. Now, we do know from a contemporary evidence that Shakespeare spent some time as a schoolmaster in the country. And then there was the uncovered evidence through some wills at the time that an actor called William Shakeshaft, which was a name that Shakespeare's father also used, was present as a schoolmaster at Houghton Hall, which is a recusant household, aristocratic English recusants living near Preston, just north of Manchester in Lancashire. And he, it seemed that the evidence would suggest that Shakespeare spent some time at that house. And what's very intriguing about this, and several scholars have sort of have waxed lyrical on this possibility, is that would have put Shakespeare within about 5 or 6 miles of where St. Edmund Campion was shortly before his arrest after he came to England in 1580, when Shakespeare had only been about 16 years old.
And that would have been quite a meeting of great men. And I want to remind our listeners that for the bulk of his writing career, Elizabeth I of England reigned. And she was no friend to Catholics, although I think some of the more recent films about Elizabeth have rather overdone it. Is that the case?
Well, yeah. Basically, she was absolutely no friend of Catholics, mostly because, quite frankly, she was a Machiavella, if you want to make it feminine, I suppose. and so she's really mostly concerned with ensuring her own power. That's one of the reasons why she never married, because she didn't want to share power with anybody. So the Catholic Church was obviously perceived as being a threat to Her Majesty, and in consequence, she was fairly ruthless in her attacks upon the Catholic Church. There's no doubt at all that Queen Elizabeth was hostile to Catholicism, and there are one or two references in Shakespeare's plays that seem to be barbed references to her, at least as close to her as you dare get without risking imprisonment.
So he spent his last 13 years of his life under James I, who continued to keep Catholics at bay, but didn't really become openly hostile toward them until the so-called Gunpowder Plot. Is that correct?
Yes, which was very soon after his accession to the throne, however. So effectively, James I's reign was as anti-Catholic as Elizabeth. I mean, initially, there were great hopes amongst the Catholics that they were really holding on for Elizabeth to die. I mean, but by the time Shakespeare's writing his plays, Elizabeth is an old woman, and they're just waiting for her to die in the hope that James I of Scotland, James VI of Scotland, James I of England, because he's married to a Catholic and has promised to actually to tolerate Catholicism and to drop most of the really egregious laws against Catholics. There was real hope that when he came to the throne that a time of religious liberty would be heralded. And at first, to be fair to him, he did endeavor to do that. But by this time, Parliament, which was then very, very powerful and, of course, rising in power, and within 40 years would actually, of course, presage the English Civil War, which would lead to the defeat of the king by Parliament. But Parliament was powerful enough in the reign of James I that they basically threatened the king, and the king, feeling insecure as a new monarch, basically was answered to the threats of Parliament and reintroduced the recusancy laws as badly as Elizabeth had done. And it was that anger that led, that should we say, the hotheads to be sucked into the gunpowder plot. And then when that happened, of course, that was the excuse to say, well, all Catholics are traitors, all Catholics are terrorists, and that just accentuated.
And we should remind our readers that the gunpowder plot, led by Guy Fawkes, was a Catholic scheme to blow up Parliament and perhaps get the king included in the outcomes of that plot. And they evidently caught Guy Fawkes standing with the gunpowder. Isn't that correct?
They did, but the reason for that, as historians such as Antonia Fraser have shown, is that the whole plot from the beginning was actually contrived by James's spy network, and the conspiracy itself was riddled with the king's spies. So they knew all along that it was going to happen, which is why they let Guy Fawkes go right up to the very hilt and caught him red-handed, because that obviously maximizes the...
Did they do anything to actually try to instigate it so they could have an excuse, or what?
Well, they basically, there were spies amongst the conspirators acting as agents provocateurs, that leading people on and facilitating things such as the obtainment of the explosives. So basically facilitating the possibility of the whole thing, obviously never intending it would ever be able to be carried through. The idea was always, what exactly happened was to take them red-handed in delecto flagrante, shall we say, and then have them sacrificed. Guy Fawkes and his co-conspirators sacrificed, burned to death, and as an example to everyone else.
So this was November 5th, 1605, just 2 years after Elizabeth passed away, and Shakespeare would have had another 8 years of active authorship. So he would have been once again, under the reign of a very anti-Catholic author. But isn't it the case, I mean, King, but isn't it the case that Shakespeare pushed the envelope quite a bit in his plays of showing himself to be very admirable of Catholicism and often putting a character, an admirable, virtuous, even saintly character, presenting them as a Catholic?
Absolutely. And the way he got around the law, because the law at the time made it illegal to talk about contemporary religion and politics on the stage, so you couldn't comment on the current religion and politics. Of course, it would be foolhardy to do so anyway, because you'd be thrown in prison. But the point is, it was illegal to do so. So the way he got around that was by setting his plays in two places, either in places like Italy, which were Catholic, or in the English past. You know, obviously, in his time, you only had to go back 100 years, less than 100 years, for a Catholic England. So he set his plays either in the past or on the continent, so that it was natural enough to have friars and nuns and Catholic figures, which, as you say, that almost invariably are depicted in a positive light. And as importantly, and we shouldn't forget, the villains of his plays are always Machiavells. And we need to remember that basically that what Shakespeare was dealing with and what the English Catholics were dealing with was a Machiavellian, effectively secular regime, secularist regime, that basically put politics above religion and the needs of the state above religion. And so Shakespeare's villains are always Machiavells. So there's a very, very... So his heroes are Christian, who practice traditional Orthodox Christian virtue and teach and preach traditional Orthodox Christian doctrine. And his villains are Machiavellian, worldly, secular figures. I mean, it speaks for itself.
Is this something that would mirror Henry VIII's own motives for breaking with the Catholic Church, in your opinion?
Yes, I mean, I think that the whole the Henry VIII's break with Rome was a secular fundamentalist revolution. The state basically took the power of religion. It instigated the state religion in place of the traditional Catholic religion against the will of the people. I mean, all the historical evidence shows that there
was... and against the will of some of his best friends and counselors.
Absolutely, including most famously, of course, St. Thomas More. But the evidence has shown, for instance, the number of religious houses in England was far above the average throughout the rest of Christendom. England was a very happily Catholic country. Unlike in parts of Germany and France, there was very little appetite for the fledgling Reformation in England. So the English Reformation is nothing like the Continental Reformation and should not be seen as being synonymous with it. Whereas the Continental Reformation was a question of doctrine and theological differences, the English Reformation was merely a question of the state grabbing power that wasn't rightfully its.
So really, by the time of Shakespeare, which would have been, 60, 70 years after the death of Henry, would the theology of the Anglican Church, not the liturgy, but would the theology of the Anglican Church be substantially different from that of Catholics?
Well, the thing with the Anglican Church is that because it was a state religion, it had a crisis of identity from the very beginning. So in some sense, there was a continuum. In other words, of course, most of the bishops and priests, lamentably but not surprisingly, chose their own necks over defying the king. So they continued, and of course they were Catholic, had been Catholic. So there was this continuum in liturgy up to a point. But then, of course, the reformers tagged themselves onto the religion. Thomas Cranmer, of course, very quickly became a major influence in England, eventually becoming Archbishop of Canterbury. So you had one from the very beginning, these two strands that are mutually incompatible, sort of what you might call low church Protestantism and a high church sort of pseudo-Catholicism. And that really carried on this sort of Jekyll and Hyde schizophrenic ecclesiology. It has been at the heart of Anglicanism from its beginning until the present day.
So the ways in which Shakespeare would have been subversive would be challenging this notion of a state church or a church that is actually run by the head of state.
Yes, and if you actually look, during the reign of Elizabeth, many of the villains are, it's a question of... It's a question of legitimacy, you know, they're all playing on whether someone is legitimate heir to the throne, legitimately the king, and and that's because, of course, for Catholics, there was a question mark over whether Queen Elizabeth I was legitimate. I mean, she was the daughter of Anne Boleyn, who was, of course, the concubine of Henry VIII, and the divorce with Catherine of Aragon was obviously not sanctioned by the church and therefore was illicit. So there was this question over the head of whether Elizabeth was even a legitimate child. And if you're not a legitimate child, you can't be a legitimate heir. So there's that question. And in his Elizabethan plays, Shakespeare toys and plays with this idea of legitimacy. Whereas under the Jacobean plays, because there was no question at all in anybody's mind that James I was a legitimate heir to the throne, under that it's not a question anymore of legitimacy, but of the king behaving in a Machiavellian fashion, which was illicit in itself because it went against the moral law.
Well, did you publish the book on Romeo and Juliet separately because you felt that it had the greatest amount of evidence for Shakespeare being a Catholic, or did you just want to clarify some of the mythology surrounding the meaning of that play?
Mostly the latter. Romeo and Juliet has ample evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism, as to all the plays that I've studied, but it's not more Catholic than others. It's less Catholic than some in terms of, you know, the obvious Catholic allusions and references that you can draw from it. No, primarily I was trying to address the misunderstanding and misreading of the play, which makes Romeo and Juliet's love something beautiful and pure, and it's the stupid adults that are the problem. And quite clearly, when you read the play scene by scene, carefully. It's quite clear that Shakespeare is using his cautionary tale against the dangers of unbridled passion, whether it's the unbridled passion of hatred that the parents are suffering from, or the unbridled passion of so-called love, so erotic, lust-driven relationships, on the other hand, of Romeo and Juliet. And I, that's what I wanted the show, and that's what the book does, and that's why I spent the whole book on the play. I mean, I think in order to really prove an exposition of the play, you have to go through in its entirety. You have to go through it scene by scene. You can't pluck, as some critics do, I don't want to mention any names, but pluck isolated lines to prove a point. But if you do that, you know, I could play devil's advocate and pluck some other lines that prove the opposite. I mean,
right.
Prove anything.
You start proof texting each other back and forth.
Exactly. You have to be methodical and start from act one, scene one, and go through to the final act and final scene of the play. And that's what I've done in Romeo and Juliet. That's why it's a whole book on the one play.
Well, you know, I must admit that, you know, I've been reading Romeo and Juliet on and off my entire life. It was the Shakespeare play I had in 11th grade back in Fort Worth, Texas. And then, of course, great fan of the Zeffirelli movie and a fan of the old Morishira MGM version. And I've seen, you know, a number of the film versions of stage plays. I don't think I've ever seen a version of Romeo and Juliet that presents it the way you're talking about it.
Yeah, well,
is that, would you say that's probably right?
That's probably right, unfortunately. And I think the reason for that is what's happened between Shakespeare's time and our time is something which we might call the Romantic Revolution. And with Romanticism at the end of the 18th century, which was a reaction against, if you like, the cold-hearted scientism of the Enlightenment, well, it was an overreaction. It threw the baby out with the bathwater, and then it all became about feelings. And so the whole idea of romantic love, where it's really about the feelings of the protagonist and not about the moral objectivity of the relationship. And I think that romanticism has cast a shadow really over all adaptations and presentations of the play in the 200 years since.
But what do you do with lines like, "With love's light wings I have purged these walls, for stony limits cannot keep love out, and what love can do, that there's love attempt"?
Yeah, I mean, there's no denying, and no one in their right mind would deny that Shakespeare does not put beautiful lines into the mouths of Romeo and Juliet. It's beautiful poetry, but if you actually look at the meaning, and I spend, you know, I think a whole chapter on the balcony scene.
On the balcony scene, wonderful.
Which that's at the beginning of.
And so, what did you come to conclude about that?
Well, basically, what happens is the chorus of the play makes it perfectly clear earlier on that there's no difference in kind. This is one of the big errors with the understanding of the play Romeo and Juliet. There's no difference in kind between Romeo's feelings for Rosalind and his feelings for Juliet, all right? It's the same, and the chorus actually says it, and he loves alike. There's no difference in the love. The only difference is Rosalind, for whatever reason, decides that she's not interested in Romeo. She says she has a religious vocation. She's got taken a vow of chastity. Whether that's because she does or whether that's just a lie to get rid of him, we don't know. And obviously it's a moot point but I think she's a powerful presence even though she doesn't appear, right?
And of course, at the beginning of the play, we find Romeo pining for Rosaline.
Yeah, he's what we would call lovesick. He's got this sort of lovesickness. He's pining for her. He doesn't come out at night. He shuts himself up. So he doesn't come out during the day. He shuts himself up in his room, and it's a madness. It's referred to over and over again as a madness by several characters. Then the chorus says that, you know, that he loves alike. He loves in the like in the same manner. There's no difference in the love. The only difference is in Juliet, he finds someone that doesn't say no. And one of the reasons for that is because Juliet is very young, and Shakespeare deliberately makes her younger. She's not yet 13 years old. I mean, she's still 12. I mean, it's ridiculous. And again, you hear this, you know, the critics say, oh, yeah, well, in those days, it was not uncommon for 13-year-olds to get married. Absolute nonsense. There's been research to show that the average age for a marriage for men in Elizabeth's England, at the time Shakespeare's writing the play, the average age for men marrying was mid to late 20s. The average age for women marrying was early 20s. So it's pretty common. Marrying under the age of 18 was extremely rare. And marrying under the age of 16 was actually thought dangerous to the woman's health.
We're going to have to take a short break, Joseph Pierce. We're talking about Shakespeare, Catholicism, and the meaning of Romeo and Juliet. I'm sure you'll stay with us. Come back with us after this short break.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Dunha-Garmo, co-publisher and editor-in-chief of the Chaldean News. It's a news magazine for the Chaldean community, about the Chaldean community, and for anyone who wants to engage the Chaldean community. As Christians from Iraq, Chaldeans are proud supporters of Ave Maria Catholic Radio. We invest many hours into this monthly news magazine to keep you invested in the community. You can subscribe or advertise today. Contact us at www.chaldeannews.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
I think I'm pregnant.
Really? What are you going to do?
What choice do I have?
She has a choice. It's ICUDetroit.com. Image clear ultrasound or ICU in the womb. We bring hope to women in need. And where there's hope, there are life-affirming choices. We are Michigan's first mobile ultrasound unit, servicing the Detroit metro area, providing free pregnancy tests, ultrasounds, and non-judgmental peer counseling. All services and care take place in our spacious mobile unit, which has a private exam room with a state-of-the-art 3D ultrasound and a separate lounge area for family or friends. If your church, congregation, or youth group is interested in learning more about this ministry, please call 248-620-5353 or visit us at ICUDetroit.com. That's the letters ICUDetroit.com or 248-620-5353. ICUDetroit.com.
Light of the East. Weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, we have come to the week of the bridegroom, in which we witness not only Christ on the cross, but individuals who themselves are willing, in our own time, to go to the cross on behalf of the bride of Christ.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Back with Joseph Pierce. Joseph's well known to many Catholics for his many books about literary figures and about Catholics and culture in general. He is now the director of the Center for Faith and Culture at Aquinas College in Nashville, Tennessee. We're talking about his book on Romeo and Juliet entitled Shakespeare on Love, which was published in 2013. Joseph wants to take all the fun out of it, strip it of all its romance, and treat it as a morality play. Is that fair, Joseph?
Well, it may be a slightly simplistic way of putting it. I think Romeo and Juliet is still a lot of fun, but just not the sort of fun that most other people think it is. But to get back to what we were saying before, you know, that Shakespeare deliberately makes Juliet 12 years old, not quite 13 years old, 10 years younger than the average marrying age. She's a girl. At the time he writes Romeo and Juliet, 1597, he has a daughter himself who's about Juliet's age. He's writing as a...
Ah. I'm
sorry to be such a, you know, a damp squib for those that have...
But that, I mean, you're making a good argument. That's, I like that.
There's a whole starry-eyed way of looking at
it. How old is Romeo?
Well, again, Shakespeare's source play, he makes Juliet younger than she is in the source play. He seems to make Romeo somewhat older. We don't actually get Romeo's age; it's not given to us. But you know, he's old enough to defeat Tybalt in a sword fight. I mean, he's not a boy. So you know, if we guess, he's late teens, 19, something like that. She's 12 or 13. She's 12 going on 13. You know, in some ways, this is creepy.
And it's almost child molestation.
Well, yeah, if you actually look at the play, we have Juliet is innocent. She has conventional Christian morality, and she's confused at first by this attention, and then she's seduced by the attention, and then she's hook, line, and sinker involved with Romeo. So Romeo really, quite frankly, is a cad. Juliet is an innocent victim. It's not the conventional way, but I would argue it was the conventional way in Shakespeare's time. And I certainly in my book show the evidence, not only biographical, but more to the point textual, by going through scene by scene, as I say. Even the line you quote, you know, what love can do, love will do, is where's the should in that?
Right, that's right.
You know, there's an absence of moral imperative. And immediately, you know, that soon as Friar Lawrence doesn't give Romeo the solace of being able to get what he wants when he's being banished, he's threatening to kill himself. The whole idea of suicide. The imagery, by the way, of the death scene is very, very phallic, very sexual, that Juliet is killed with Romeo's dagger. I could go on and on. Obviously, I have.
Well, what about Friar Lawrence? I mean, I would say that most of the renditions of the play I've seen look upon Friar Lawrence as egging them on.
Well, I think there's two things about Friar Lawrence. When we first meet him, the advice he gives is conventional Christian wisdom about love, actually warning them to control their passions and to wait and what have you. So if you actually look at his early speeches, provide us with some of the real moral gravitas that we need to be able to see and understand the play by. But then he very foolishly thinks that maybe this union will bring peace between the families. So he's a well-intentioned idiot, which is basically what he calls himself at the end when he makes the full confession. So I think with Friar Lawrence, what we have is someone who is well-meaning but naive in believing that allowing these two to marry at such a reckless speed and at such young age was somehow going to bring peace between the families was hopelessly naive and simplistic. He says so himself. The final judgment on Friar Lawrence is his final speech of self-recrimination, after which the prince says, "We still have known thee as a holy man." In other words, okay, well, we accept your confession, and yes, you are partly culpable for what's happened, but you are still a holy man, and we accept you as such. And that's essentially the way that Friar Lawrence is depicted in the play.
I'm talking with Joseph Pierce about Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, but isn't it the case that the entire history of the English monarchy is about using marriage as a way of forging alliances between nations?
Well, yes, it is, I'm not talking about the way that marriages are used by state in Machiavellian ways. We're talking here about a 12 coming off a 13.
But it wouldn't have been unusual for Friar Lawrence to think of marriage in that way.
Well, I think it would, because, I mean, this is not, first of all, a Franciscan friar does not broker those marriages. Those sort of marriage we see in the play when Juliet's father, Capulet, arranges for her to marry.
And they wait, until the appropriate time to get married.
Right, exactly. Those sort of state, staged marriages, arranged marriages, are actually, obviously, they involve the parents. You don't have a loose cannon of a friar, if you forgive my pun. The loose cannon of the friar sort of doing erratic things. That's not how these things are brokered. That's just bringing anarchy into the proceedings, which is exactly what happens. And of course, to be fair to Friar Lawrence, you know, that he is outmaneuvered by Providence, and I would argue as well that's an aspect of it. The fact that he can't get the message to Romeo on time, that he's outmaneuvered by Providence, suggests that he should not be doing what he's doing.
He himself is seeing the prophecy he made about what happens when passion goes uncontrolled.
Exactly. And he sees that at the end and knows it at the end. Of course, it's too late for Romeo and Juliet. And that's the tragedy of it, of course, is that these two young lovers are dead. But let's not forget also they commit suicide. Hamlet, when Hamlet's suicidal in the famous to be or not to be soliloquy, now it's the fear of punishment in hell for the sin of self-slaughter that stays his hand. Shakespeare's not all of a sudden making heroes and heroines of people who commit the mortal sin of suicide.
Well, if we look at Shakespeare's corpus, and we look at what do we have, 38 plays, known plays? Is that correct?
I'm not exactly sure the number was. Do you count, include Henry VIII, Thomas IV,
right,
et cetera?
If you were, and you must have done this, I think, in your second book, Through Shakespeare's Eyes, I believe was the title. Did you, in that book, pick out plays that you thought best illustrated how these plays express a Catholic faith?
Well, yes. Also, of course, I selected plays that I knew better than others, purely pragmatic decision, that some plays I know better than others, obviously. And I haven't actually yet come across a play that does not have a Catholic dimension that can be plucked from it. But certainly the plays I selected for that book, Hamlet and King Lear and The Merchant of Venice, are all plays that have an abundance of evidence for the playwright's Catholicism.
Of course, and they're all set in an age prior to the Reformation.
Yes.
So there's no issue of Shakespeare being seen as evangelizing for the papist religion.
Right. He couldn't do that because the plays would simply be banned. In fact, there was a play that came out just before Macbeth, the same time Macbeth, which was actually looking at a plot, a conspiracy called the Gowrie Conspiracy that King James was involved in when he was King of Scotland, shortly becoming King of England. And it was hugely popular, but was banned after just a few performances. And Shakespeare's Macbeth, it seems, was a response to how do we tell the same story and get away with it. And what you do, you take a historical figure like Macbeth, who, as you say, is prior to the Reformation and therefore safe in that regard. But then you draw all sorts of obvious analogies between Macbeth and what King James was accused of doing. So, you know, that's one thing. But as you say, in the case of Hamlet, it's set in medieval times, so pre-Reformation. Case of King Lear, ancient Britain, so again, pre-Reformation. And in the case of Merchant of Venice, of course, it's set in Italy, so in Venice. So, in all three cases, he safely situates his play in a Catholic environment by placing either in the past or in a foreign country.
So we have a Christian cosmology, which it comes out, for example, in the famous speech at the end of The Merchant of Venice.
Oh, yes.
And which I'm going to withhold from quoting at length because it's one of my favorite speeches in Shakespeare. But you have this Christian cosmology of an ordered universe as represented by what we see up in the sky.
Right.
That famous opening page of C.S. Lewis's Discarded Image, where he contrasts the ordered Christian cosmos of the Middle Ages with that which began to emerge during the Renaissance, when you, all of a sudden you looked up and you saw infinity. You didn't see order.
Right.
But drilling down beyond the cosmology, beyond the sort of sense of place, you know, what Catholic themes show up the most often in Shakespeare's plays?
Well, actually, what I'd like to do, if you allow me, dear, is actually take you up where you were there with that particular speech.
Okay.
Because there's all sorts of things going on there. Because, of course, you know, it's about the music of the spheres, and that's what you say.
See how the moonlight sleeps upon this bank is the way it starts.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all about the music of the spheres. The music of the spheres, of course, is not just the movement of the planets. It's the mystical great music of God's order in the cosmos. Well, that's the first thing. But the other thing here, you know, beware of someone about the treason, stratagems, and spoils. Mark the music.
Yeah, don't trust anyone who doesn't love music.
Exactly. And, of course, again, from the point of view of Shakespeare's only time, when he's writing this play in the 1590s, the Puritans, who are on the rise, are doing everything in their power to exorcise and eliminate music from the liturgy. They're also doing everything they can to get the theater banned, and eventually, after Shakespeare's time, actually succeed in doing so.
Under Cromwell's protectorate.
Exactly, so closing things down. So Shakespeare was also in this, as well as the profoundly orthodox cosmology you're talking about, but also having a sideswipe at those who those who have no music in their soul should not be trusted. They're fit for only trees and stratagems and spoils. You know, don't trust the Puritans, basically. Even in that particular speech, there's more going on than the mere Christian cosmology.
So there's this entire kind of a Christian anthropology about the way in which the human person should participate in the divine beauty, divine goodness, the divine truth.
Yeah, and music in that broadest understanding of the word of that which is inspired by the muses.
Yeah, it represents an ordered soul.
Yeah, not just music, but creativity in a more general sense and our relationship with the Creator. It's, yes, an ordered self responding to creativity.
Okay, now then the question I just asked, though, coming down to earth a little bit, or at least getting out of the realm of anthropology and cosmology, what kind of themes do we – I mean, you mentioned Lear. Is it forgiveness there you have in mind?
Well, I think the most important thing with Lear is it's the conversion of Lear himself. And you certainly the play is set up with posing a dilemma, which is exactly the dilemma which English Catholics had at the time, where basically the king says to his daughters that they have to, in order to inherit the kingdom, in order to have their rights, they have to tell the king how much they love him.
Right.
So the two wicked...
The demand to go to church.
Exactly. The oath of supremacy, that if you don't sign the oath of supremacy, you're sent to prison or fined. If you don't go to Anglican services, you're fined. And so the two conformist sisters, the two duplicitous sisters, tell the king what he wants to hear, even though they don't believe it.
Right.
What the king wants to hear. Whereas the true sister, the true daughter, Cordelia, says, I must love and be silent.
In other words, the other two sisters recanted their faith, as it were.
Exactly. They denied their true beliefs in order to satisfy the demands of the king. Whereas Cordelia sacrifices herself for her true beliefs in refusing to kowtow before the king, and in consequence, of course, she's exiled, which is what happens to numerous Catholics.
Well, probably thousands of English Catholics.
There were thousands of English Catholics on the continent, and
yes,
many of them in France, by the way. And it's the King of France, of course, who takes her in. But the key thing, of course, is and Lear is a complex play, and we have a limited amount of time, obviously. And about a third of my book is spent just on Lear. But the key thing is Lear begins as a worldly-minded person. He has a conversion on the heath where he strips naked in emulation of St. Francis of Assisi. He has nothing but his lendings, as he puts them. Everything is lent. He owns nothing. And that's, of course, true of our life. We don't own our lives. We owe our lives. And then he has his profound conversion experience. And it's then when he's apparently mad, as Francis of Assisi was apparently mad, that he really comes to his senses.
And Francis stripped. Naked.
Exactly. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you want the motif to make the connection, the song that's being sung just before he strips his clothes off about going through the hawthorn, I can't remember the exact quote of it now, is actually a plucked from a Franciscan ballad. So it gives us the Franciscan connection before King Lear strips all of his clothes off. And then the very final scene of the play, almost, is when Lear has this vision of the resurrected Cordelia. It's almost a reverse Pietà, where the father is cradling the dead daughter. But the final vision he has is one of where he's delirious, but he's deliriously happy because he has a vision of the resurrected Cordelia. So from Lear's perspective, it's a happy ending. Now, from a worldly perspective, it's madness. But that's the paradox that Shakespeare is working with.
Now, something occurs to me to ask, and that is, have you ever looked at the issue of Shakespeare's Catholicism by contrasting it with other plays of the same period, like those of Marlowe or Jonson? I mean, are there things in Shakespeare that aren't in those plays because of Shakespeare's Catholicism?
Yes, when you actually compare Shakespeare's plays with the plays of his contemporaries, these Catholic elements are evident in Shakespeare, and they're emphatically not evident in the plays, particularly of Marlowe and Decker and people like that. Johnson, of course, is a bit more of a problematic figure. But even in his plays, I can't recall there being anything as obviously Catholic, which is in abundance in these Shakespeare's plays. I mean, we could go on for another five shows.
Well, we might. I know you did a series of shows on EW10 about this, which I strongly recommend people go and find.
Seriously, so that's.
But you should have had me interviewing you because I could have pulled it all out of you. But
yeah, well, I would have suggested to Doug Keck.
Now, but then that leads me to the next question: could you make the argument beyond Shakespeare's verbal skill and writing skill that it was his faith that he put to use in forming the world and the character of his plays that made it a cut above not just the plays of his time, but the plays of all time?
Yes, I think it's all connected. I think, first of all, God had bestowed upon William Shakespeare not just five talents, but six to stretch even Christ's parable. I mean, he was a man with considerable artistic gifts. But when you put that, we have a man who has a genuine faith and genuine principle, and therefore he's not just interested in pleasing the crowd or moving with the zeitgeist, but he's responding, if you like, to the Heiliger Geist, to the spirit, the Holy Spirit, not the spirit of the age. And I think that there's a timelessness in his plays because he's dealing with those timeless issues. He's not dealing with the zeitgeist, because the thing when you deal with the spirit of the age, as C.S. Lewis said, you know, fashions are always coming and going, but mostly going. So many of the other plays of Shakespeare's time appear dated because they were very, very relevant for what was happening in Elizabethan and Jacobean England. Shakespeare is dealing with timeless verities because he's dealing with the unending battle between the church and the world, between the powers of this world and those who follow Christ.
But you think, for example, his history plays. I mean, a lot of the plays of his age were based upon histories, especially of England and the monarchy, but yet they remain dated while Shakespeare's history plays remain vital and vibrant and present to us.
Yeah, and that's precisely because it's dealing with the timeless moral verities and not with, you know, from a philosophical perspective, the accidental aspects of the history, you know, who did what, when, and what have you, which are very important for the historian, but unless you're a historian, is not going to be very communicative to everybody else, whereas the morality of things, the morality of decisions, right and wrong decisions, the consequences of right and wrong decisions, the consequences of evil, the response of virtue in the face of evil. These are things that touch upon all of us in every day of our lives. So, of course, that aspect, which is clearly the thing that interests Shakespeare most, is also what gives his work that timeless quality.
Why did Shakespeare, whether he did he or not intend to leave very little record of his own personal life?
Well, this is not surprising. If insofar as Shakespeare, the two things. First of all, insofar as Shakespeare's a Catholic, the whole aspect of his life which is Catholic, there's going to be no paper chase, no paper record.
Because it would have meant imprisonment.
Exactly. Well, you're talking about illegal activities, illegal people, if you like, an underworld. Well, you don't leave a written record of that. So throughout his own lifetime, part of the reason we know very little about Shakespeare is the fact that he is a Catholic. That would explain it. And also the reason we know relatively little about Shakespeare is the fact that for about 50 years or so after he died, there was a nadir, if you like, an interest of him, first of all. And then by the time he was rediscovered, England was well and truly a Protestant country, and insofar as Shakespeare was admired, that aspect of his Catholicism was either not known or not mentioned. And then you have 200 years of accumulated accretion of legend that replaces the facts of his life. You put all that together, and that itself explains why we don't know as much about Shakespeare as we might otherwise have done. But I would add that my first book, The Quest for Shakespeare, is only looking at the biographical evidence. There's a whole book there accumulating evidence from other people's research, giving the evidence from his life, literally from documents that we have of his life, showing that he is a Catholic. So what we do know about Shakespeare shows his Catholicism. We don't know as much as we should because he's a Catholic.
Well, one thing, Joseph, I read getting ready to talk to you I read an account of the way in which Shakespeare became, in a way, a symbol of English Protestantism and rejection of the Catholic Church.
Yeah,
That obviously wasn't fair. How did that happen in the first place?
Well, basically, think what happened to England afterwards. Let me give you a practical, really, example here. My father, who was very anti-Catholic, I talk about this in my book Race with the Devil. He considered and always brought me up to believe that Shakespeare was the greatest Englishman that ever lived. In fact, Shakespeare really was, you know, a real-life Uncle Sam. He was the person that epitomized what England was, what it was to be English. So as England metamorphosed into Britain, and then metamorphosed from Britain into empire, Shakespeare became this mythical person, a bit like Robin Hood, you know.
Right.
And so this mythical Shakespeare eclipsed and replaces the real human Shakespeare. And, of course, this mythical Shakespeare has to reflect the religion or the lack thereof of the British Empire and the British people. So this mythical Shakespeare is either a Protestant or not particularly religious at all. He certainly isn't a Catholic.
You know, Joseph, as in every time we talk, whether we're on or off, we've run out of time. So Joseph Pierce, who is now at Aquinas College in Nashville and is head of the Center for Faith and Culture, thanks for being a guest once again on Church and Culture.
My pleasure, Dale. God bless you.
Look forward to having you again. And to all of you who are listening, please stay with me. After this break, I have another very interesting guest.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. The annual Divine Mercy Novena begins Friday, April 3rd at St. Albert the Great Church in Dearborn Heights. Father Dan Zaleski, Father Ben Ludke, and Father John Hedges will each be preaching during this 9-evening event to celebrate the wonder of the Lord's amazing mercy. For further details, call 313-770-3203. Holy Spirit Catholic Church in Brighton invites you to a Shroud of Turin exhibit on Holy Saturday. Over 20 panels will be on display, including several that display new research that would seem to date the Shroud back to biblical times and locate it to the Holy Lands. For more information, call 810-231-9199, extension 202. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. Catholic Radio, it's yours to keep and to grow.
Hi, Deacon Tom here, asking for phone volunteers for Ave Maria Radio Spring Membership Drive, April 6th through the 10th. We start the Monday after Easter. It's coming soon. If you or your group can spare a couple of hours of time, April 6th through the 10th, just call Cheryl Bertil at 877-288-1077 or send her an email at volunteer@AveMariaRadio.net. Another easy way to help is to go to our homepage at AveMariaRadio.net and click the volunteer button. God bless you.
This is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. The Seventh Commandment declares, "You shall not steal." Whenever we violate the right to life, we steal. We rob the person of what is his, the recognition of his rights, the protection of his life. Actions like abortion also rob God himself of what is his. Once when I was praying at an abortion facility with a group of people and one man had his toes over the property line, a clinic worker shouted, "Get your feet off our property." I responded, "And when are you going to get your hands off God's property?" God alone has dominion over human life. When an abortionist reaches into the sacred space of the womb to rip the child apart, he is stealing from the Almighty. It is also robbing society itself of the respect it owes for life. This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
Palm Sunday has a procession on the longest gospel of the year, so I'm just going to touch on some excerpts. Jesus and the 12 were eating the Passover, and he said, "Amen, I say to you, one of you here will betray me." And he suffered this for you. And while they were eating, he took bread, said the blessing, and gave it to them, saying, "Take this, this is my body." And then he took a cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which will be shed for many." And then they went to Gethsemane, where he began to be troubled and distressed. "My soul is sorrowful even to death," he said. "Remain here and keep watch." But then they went to sleep while he sweated blood, and he suffered this for you.